To LSE's Share Talks Conker's Corner. This morning I have the pleasure of speaking with Nick Britton. Nick Britton is the head of training at the Association of Investment Companies, and his main responsibility is training financial advisors. Nick is also the ex-editor of What Investment. Good morning, Nick. How are you?
Good morning. I'm very well, thanks.
Okay, so whereabouts are you this morning, Nick?
Well, I'm in the office in London, here near Moorgate Station.
Okie dokie. So, you do a lot of travelling around, though, because I've been chasing you for a couple of weeks now. You cover the length and breadth of the country, don't you?
Yes, and sometimes even go outside the country. So we've just come back from the Channel Islands as well.
Right, but, okay.
Yes. Most of the travel is within the UK, though. And but I've just got over the busiest time for that now, and we're in the quieter summer months for training.
Okie doke, because I did notice, I think about a week or so ago, that your very good colleague, Annabelle Brodie-Smith, was caught in the fog and trapped on ships and ferries and stuff.
Yes. It was my first trip to the Channel Islands.
Right.
So it didn't go very well.
Didn't go well.
Travel-wise, we had fog, we had diversions. I ended up in Exeter, supposed to be in Guernsey. So all in all, yes, it wasn't great. But, I'm sure I'll be back. Hopefully next time I will learn from it and travel in the middle of the day, because I think the fog is better at that time.
Right. Okie dokie. Now, Nick, I wanted to first start with the interview this morning, really, just touching on your background and where it all started for you, you know, from when you were teens doing your degree or otherwise to the present day, really, so everyone gets a feel of who Nick Britton is.
Okay, well, I was born up north. I was born in Bolton, actually, which a lot of people, it surprises a lot of people because I don't really sound like it.
Not anymore, no.
Yeah. I lost whatever accent I had, and unless you've got a very good ear, you can't tell.
Yeah.
I read English at Cambridge. I then had no idea what I wanted to do, so I decided to go to China. And the fact it was China rather than somewhere else was just sheer luck. I applied for about 8 jobs teaching English abroad. The guys in Shanghai were first to get back to me and offer me the job, so I decided to go there. Could just have easily have been Turkey or you know, somewhere else. So that was complete chance. It really kind of shaped my life because I ended up meeting my wife over in China.
Excellent.
I was 3 years in Shanghai, started off teaching English, then worked on a magazine there. Yeah. And had a great time, actually. Then lived in Australia for a bit. Came to London about 10 years ago, got married, and I've been in London ever since, and working mainly in the media industry. So I, as you've already mentioned, I was editor of What Investment magazine for 3 years. I was also head of research at a company called Vitesse Media, looking into investment companies, VCTs, and growing businesses in the UK. So I've been very lucky. It's been a very interesting sort of career so far. And I moved to the AIC just over a year ago.
Okay. So you're just celebrating your anniversary of being there then?
Well, that's right. Yeah, I'm coming up to my sort of 1.5-year anniversary of that.
Yeah.
That means about, but I mean, we're an organisation where people tend to work for a very long time. So, 1.5 years is nothing.
No, I was speaking to Annabelle and she's been there for a significant amount of time as well, hasn't she?
She's coming up to her 19 years, I think.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if I should say that or not. But anyway, I think the average length of service is probably about 10 to 15 years here.
Fantastic. So they're trying to stay with the company as long as some of the fund managers you have on the funds have stuck with their funds.
That's right. That's a very good point. I mean, yeah, we are a sector where a lot of fund managers have served for a very long time. And 49% of our fund managers have been there, you know, at least 10 years. So
yeah, that's so good.
Good to see that.
Yeah, because they can go through the cycles then, can't they? That's pretty good. Now, Nick, given that you started as an English major and went abroad to teach, when did you first get an interest in the investment arena?
Sure. Well, I was always interested in money and saving right from when I was a little kid, you know, and saving up my pounds in the piggy bank. But I didn't have any family background in sort of finance or investment. Nobody in my family knew anything about it.
Yeah.
And I didn't really get interested in it until actually came back to London. And in my first job, my boss was going on about it. He liked to look at the indices every day, talk about where the Nikkei was and you know, how his shares and funds were doing. So that's when I started to get interested in this and thought, well, if you know, if he can do it, then maybe I can do it.
So when was that around then?
That's around 2006 that I opened my first sort of stocks and shares ISA and got involved in it.
Okay. And when you first started in 2006 in your stocks and shares ISA, were you then straight away looking at funds or were you looking more at equities?
No, I've always been investor in funds. I never bought direct shares, although I have sort of covered them as a journalist. And I think the main reason for that is that I just have never thought that I have the time or actually the expertise to be a stock picker. And that's preferred to leave that to a professional fund manager.
Okie dokie. So given that you tend to, you always invest in funds, is there particular sectors which you tend to go have more in your portfolio of, or do you have a nice mix?
Well, I think I've got a fair mix. I mean, I'm a very long-term investor because I've you know, recently opened a SIP, and it's going to be, those investments are going to be there a long time.
Yeah.
I'm sort of mid-30s, so I'm not looking at retiring for a while. so what I have actually is, it's all investment companies at the moment. It's about 60-40 split between developed and emerging markets, and I've got within the 40% emerging, I've got about 10% in frontier markets. Only about 20% of the UK. I've got a big bias towards smaller companies. It's about 70% of the portfolio is in small and mid caps versus 30 in large caps. And I've got a sort of fairly even split between Europe, America, and Asia, probably a bit less in America than most people would have, and a bit more in Asia.
Okay, that seems like a really good balance there. You've got, you covered everything there. So the fund managers are providing you with the expertise and the coverage, so you get that diversification without the dilution as such.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people would think it was quite aggressive on an asset allocation point to have 40% in emerging markets. It's a lot more than most advisors would probably recommend.
Yeah.
In my view, it's very, very long term.
Okay.
And, you know, over the next two or three decades.
Yeah, that's how long you're looking out,
is going to be. And I'm also happy to have a lot in smaller. I'm even more happy, actually, with my over-allocation to smaller companies. I think the evidence that they outperform larger over long periods is just so convincing.
Yeah, and that's shown itself over the last 20 years, really, that they've outperformed the FTSE 100 and 350 as well, haven't they? Smaller companies have.
Exactly. I mean, okay, the mid caps have done well, the FTSE 250 particularly well.
Yeah.
I think, mid and smallers are, you know, much more attractive on a longer term basis. And I think you've got this phenomenon now also where the very smallest companies are disappearing off the radar of institutional investors. And that actually creates opportunities for smaller investors who don't need to allocate £1 billion to a market to actually get in. Some of these companies are at sort of almost ridiculously low valuations because institutions aren't looking at
them. Well, that's where you find the anomalies, isn't it? That's the beauty of having access to the research and doing thorough research, is that occasionally you find those anomalies, and invariably when they come on the radar, they're the ones that either get taken over or suddenly everybody jumps on the bandwagon and says they're the next best thing.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you see what's happening in the AIM market, really, when you're getting exactly that effect, where the bigger companies in the AIM market, everyone's jumping on them before for reasons of inheritance tax, because they can get a BPR exemption for investing in AIM companies. So everyone immediately goes to the largest and sort of safest AIM companies, and now they've done very well, had a good run. But still, the smaller end of AIM is really still relatively neglected
by
analysts, institutions, people generally. So there are opportunities there, I think.
Most definitely. I mean, I recall the book by, is it Gervais Williams, who wrote The Future is Small?
Yeah, I read his books, actually, yes. And I'm a big fan of Gervais. I've met him a few times, I've read his books. And I think he makes a very convincing argument along those lines.
Okie dokie. So, given that you essentially pick funds, etc., via the funds, you pick the managers, you pick the funds. When you're going through your criteria and you're filtering which funds to buy, What criteria are you using when you're searching for those?
Okay, so the first thing I'm looking for is it's got to fit my overall asset allocation plan.
Yeah.
So, however good a gold mining fund is, I'm not going to be looking at it because it's not part of my plan to invest in
Right.
gold mining funds. So, does it have the right kind of asset allocation to fit my overall scheme? Then, of course, I'll look at the track record. Obviously, it doesn't guarantee future performance, but you know what? It does tell you something.
Yeah.
So I think the important thing, though, is not to invest in something just because it's had a very good run. So I'm always on the lookout for that.
Indeed, yeah.
And then, because I'm investing in investment companies, I'm also looking at the discount and premium. And I won't let that drive the decision. But obviously, if something's on a big premium, it will put me off. If
Yeah.
something is on a wider discount but has a great track record, then it will be an attractive factor. So, I mean, those are the three things I am looking at, more or less. I don't worry an awful lot about looking at volatility, risk-adjusted returns, Sharpe ratios, all that stuff, because it's not, with a 20, 30-year time horizon for these investments, a more volatile investment. That's not a big negative for me, to be honest.
Okay. When I was speaking to your colleague, and I've spoken to other people, including Mark Bentley of ShareSog, he was a big advocate for meeting with these fund managers and CFOs and CEOs of
Yes.
companies and looking them in the eye and checking whether they had skin in the game as such. What are your feelings on that?
So am I, absolutely. I mean, I've been very lucky, both in my work as a journalist and my work here. I'm able to meet fund managers on a regular basis. Now, not everyone has that opportunity, but they can still go to, if they invest in investment companies, they can go to the annual general meeting
Yeah.
and actually see the manager and ask questions. And I think I would encourage everyone to do that. It gives you such a great insight into what the manager's all about. Of
Yeah.
course, with the caveat that it's very easy to get carried away and convinced by some of these very compelling personalities.
Yes, I mean, especially if we touched on AIM, there are some compelling characters on there, and invariably sometimes it can be a story stock for a little while until the story unfolds.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there are some fantastically convincing CEOs of AIM companies. Yeah, you do have to bear that in mind. I mean, as a journalist, I would always get wrapped up in whoever I was interviewing and leave the interview thinking, God, I want to invest in that. But I kind of try to dampen down my natural tendency to do that and look at things more objectively. For all that, I think it's absolutely great to meet the managers and question them.
Agreed, agreed. Okay, now, given all of your journeys thus far, Nick, and the fact that you have access to these fund managers and CEOs, etc., since you started essentially in 26, 2006, what's been your greatest lesson you've learned thus far investing for yourself?
Well, I think there's so many lessons, aren't there? I'm sure you've got a few too.
Oh, yeah, I've got many.
But I think, one of them in particular is not to try to be too clever.
Yep.
And I'll give you an example of when I tried to be too clever. I saw QE happening a few years ago in a massive way in the UK, US, then Europe and Japan. And I thought everyone's trying to debase their currencies. What's going to happen is that paper money is becoming less and less valuable, and gold should see a lot of upside. So I invested in a gold mining fund.
Yep.
Now, I might or might not have been right in the long term, but I lost so much money on that in the short term. It just convinced me that's the last time I take some kind of macroeconomic view based on what I read in the papers and make an investment decision based on that.
Yeah, because it's that thing about trying to get ahead of the curve, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And
Which we all fail on.
you can be right. Dot-com boom and bust is another fantastic example. You can be right, and the internet's going to change all our lives, but it's a
Yeah.
new paradigm. And look at us on our smartphones. But
Yeah.
you can also be, you can invest in some really rubbish companies, and you can be way too early, and you can lose lots of money trying to chase those stories and follow those trends. So
Absolutely.
I don't do that anymore. I stick to diversified portfolio and let the fund managers judge when is the
Yeah.
time to jump on those, on or off those bandwagons.
Okie dokie. Nick, I wanted to just digress just a little bit onto your work side of things with the AIC. Now, you're training a vast number of financial advisors and pension advisors. Now, how does that work in a sense of are they coming to you? Are you going to them? Are you, I mean, obviously you're encouraging them because of all the changes that have happened over the last 3 to 5 years.
Yeah, a bit of both, actually. A lot of advisors want to find out more about investment companies, which they haven't traditionally used.
Yeah.
Because, frankly, they didn't get paid commission on them.
Right.
Since 2013, RDR has changed all that, and now they don't get paid commission on anything. So there's no reason why they should not consider investment companies.
Yeah.
However, a lot of them are not so familiar with them. They need more information. Our industry hasn't always been fantastic at communicating about the things we do. We were called the best kept secret, things like that.
Yeah.
So hopefully those days are gone and we're getting out there as much as we can and actually talking about some of the benefits of investment companies, but also the risks of investment companies. Because the last thing we want to do is tell a really good story, have everyone invest, and then, you know, find that things go to a discount. So we emphasize that this is for long term, but within that, you know, lots of advisors have clients that would actually be very well suited to investment companies, whether they're looking for income or, in fact, long-term wealth accumulation and growth.
No, I understand that. I mean, the great thing about it is now it feels more so like private investors and companies are getting a fairer deal now, because it's in the most interest of financial advisors to give that person, that individual, the best deal now, rather than looking out for them. Well, what was happening back in the 80s and 90s was it was a certain feel that they were looking after themselves regarding the commissions.
Yeah, I mean, there's always been great advisors even before RDR.
Of course, yeah.
There's been advisors who've actually used investment companies for 20, 30 years.
Yeah.
And who didn't actually have to change very much when RDR came in. But obviously there were other people who, you know, just reached for the most easily available product or the one that they got a commission on. So, you know, it's great that that's changed. It's great that advisors are now more open-minded about what vehicles they use. And, of course, what they should be doing is look across the whole of the market. Investment companies aren't always going to be the right choice, but, you know, you can't ignore a whole kind of investment vehicle that's been around for nearly 150 years and has really delivered, you know, fantastically well for its investors.
Yeah, agreed. I'm agreed on that. Now, obviously, we've had quite a few ruptures over the last couple of weeks, and we've had the EU ref and now Brexit. Could I have your personal take on the impact on the industry since a week ago Thursday?
Well, I think it's been a big shock, and it's been something that's immediately, you know, everybody wants to know what's going to happen now. How is it going to affect different industries? And the problem is, we just don't know.
Because it's too early. Yeah.
What the future looks like. We don't know if it looks like being outside the single market, being inside the single market, or even some people think it's a possibility we won't leave at all.
Yeah.
So, you know, until we have a clearer picture on that, it's very hard to say what the impacts might be. Obviously, for the financial services sector, thinking beyond investment companies now, looking at the sector as a whole, the thing they're worried about is passporting, being able to sell their products into the EU and being part of that regime. But can we have that without freedom of movement, which is unacceptable for a lot of people? That is a big sticking point at the moment. For our industry, for investment companies, actually the impact may not be as drastic for the simple reason we don't market very much outside the UK anyway.
Yeah.
So we don't rely on being able to sort of distribute and market outside the UK. Now, previously you could have thought that was a bit of a weakness of our sector.
Yeah, but now it's proved to be a strength,
It looks like it might be an advantage.
Yeah.
And there are also some aspects of EU regulation that haven't helped us, and that if we were to leave, might be able to be rolled back.
Yeah.
So, you know, on the whole, we were neutral on it. I mean, obviously this has a big impact on markets, it has a big impact on our members and their shareholders. So very mixed feelings, I think, that we're getting from our industry, and a lot of worry. But, you know, there could be some opportunities down the road, depending on how things develop.
Okay, thank you ever so much for that explanation. I really appreciate that. For some of our listeners, Nick, struggle with this issue of passporting. From your perspective, could you just expand on that and explain that a little bit more for us, please?
Sure. Well, all passporting is an agreement by sort of UK financial institutions to stick to the same rules as those of other EU member states. And if you stick to the same rules and regulations, that means you can market your products freely in other EU countries. So that's all it is, really, without having to get regulatory approval in those particular countries. So you get automatic rights to distribute your products more widely across the EU. So that's what it means, really. I mean, we actually, in the UK, you know, we have quite a good regulatory regime anyway. And what people sometimes misunderstand is that this isn't necessarily a load of regulation that's been imposed on the UK. Actually, the UK has been a big contributor to coming up with this regulation. And the EU's Financial Commissioner, Lord Hill, actually, who's just resigned following the referendum vote, was a major player in the EU.
Yes, he was. That was a big loss, I think.
It is a big loss.
Yeah.
Shaping regulation. So I think if people expect that, you know, once we do leave the EU, we're going to scrap all the financial regulations, that's certainly not right in my view. We're going to stay with a lot of them, because quite a lot of them we actually would have wanted it ourselves, even in, if we were independent from the EU.
Yeah. I mean, that's the difficulty we've got now, is it? And it's impacting all manner of things now. I was just talking to somebody this morning, and they were just in shock that sterling had fallen through 130, the 130 barrier after Brexit. And we've had the property funds that are stopping redemptions. I mean, what we had so far, we've had Aviva, Standard Life and M&G Investments regarding the impact of Brexit on their funds. Your thoughts on that, Nick, with these property funds and commercial property?
Yeah, I mean, we saw the first one gating, and actually, you know, some people in the AIC have seen it before, you know, the financial crisis, and when one closes, others tend to follow. I mean, it underlines the advantages of actually using a closed-ended structure if you invest in something illiquid like property, because basically there's a mismatch with these open-ended funds between what they're investing in, which is, you know, offices and buildings that can't be sold very quickly, and their promise, or not promise, but their offer of daily liquidity to their investors. Now, actually, you know, they always reserve the right to close if it's in the right interests of investors, and I think that the decision to close the funds is a sensible one. But I think what you have to question is it right to use that structure at all for investing in property? And those debates are going to very much come to the fore again.
Yeah. Okay. So, I mean, given what's happened this week with those three funds, what do you think has triggered the large-scale outflows? Is it a case of some of them are going into gold, into bonds, or are they just taking the money because they need the money elsewhere?
It's an interesting question. I mean, we don't have very much information, I think, on whether the outflows are coming from retail investors or institutions. I mean, I'm personally very interested to know that.
Yeah.
And the outflows, of course, started before the referendum happened, because you've seen, you know, months ago, these funds switching their pricing. So their pricing is actually, they're actually offering less when people sell back their units to the management groups. So they've switched to bid pricing, to use the jargon.
Yeah.
So we know the outflows were happening. They were trying to discourage the outflows before. And now they've used the nuclear option of actually closing the fund. Some people have clearly had a negative view on the UK property market for a while, whether that's because the referendum was coming and people might leave, or for some other reason. I'm not entirely sure. But certainly it's the case that a lot of people want to get out of that sector at the moment, which is interesting. Because, I mean, if you compare this to 2008, 2009, I mean, I was a journalist, you know, covering the financial crisis, and this doesn't feel... I know we've got the pound at, you know, a 31-year low, but it just isn't the same as, you know, banks going bust and queues outside Northern Rock and that kind of feeling we had in 2008.
Yeah.
I don't know what you think, but it just doesn't...
No, I agree. It just seems a bit odd, because obviously the expectations were, and all the polls were, that Remain would win. And then we had the shock. So after the shock of Leave actually winning the vote, you expect the markets to be volatile. And then the markets seem to be creeping back up. And then all of a sudden, you've had something, you know, you've got an industry valued at around, what, £35 billion of UK commercial property. Yeah. And that 7% of that is invested in commercial funds. And then all of a sudden you're getting that trickle, trickle, trickle. It's almost like people are stampeding before anything's happened.
Yeah, and I suppose that is something that's actually similar to the financial crisis, because you've got this ripple effect of one thing to another. And I remember in the financial crisis, actually, I was I was moving house, and I was the guy in the removal van. He said, "What do you do?" I said, "I'm a journalist," and he just shook his head. He said, "No, journalist, it's all your fault."
Oh, bless.
And you know, Robert Peston said something very similar. You know, he said he felt like he was being blamed for the collapse of Northern Rock just reporting on it.
Yeah.
So people do seem to think that you know, this effect of the self-fulfilling prophecy,
is
quite powerful. And you know, who knows? I mean, the open-ended property funds, it's a sign that obviously people are negative about property, but almost equally worrying seems to be the kind of loss of confidence that in itself is causing in the UK economy more generally.
Yeah, I mean, the trigger for me seems to have been the spike in gold and the accumulating losses of sterling, and people are looking where is the safest place to be, and some have made a decision that it's not commercial property. You know, that shouldn't be tarred with every property, because not every property in London has gone down 30% in the last 2 weeks, such as Persimmon and Galliford Try and Barrett have gone down. So the people are differentiating between the funds and equity and actually what's actually going down on the ground floor, because you can't pick a property up in London for 30% less than it was 2 weeks ago.
No, and I think, you know, why are you holding these property funds? If you're focused on the yield, then arguably you should hang on to them.
Yeah.
Because as long as you're still getting the income, I mean, property should be really about income. I mean, yes, about diversification, but also about income. That's what it's all about, right? You know, rental yields. The fact we've had such, you know, extraordinary capital gains on property, particularly in London and the UK in general.
Indeed, it
has blinded people to the fact that it's actually, you know, historically it's been an income asset class. So the yields now on property direct UK sector, so this is investment companies, closed-ended funds, is actually now about 6%, and they've gone out, and that's a result of them going out to a wider discount. So as long as you feel confident in the ability of those funds to carry on renting out their properties, of course, actually, you know, the yield is looking quite interesting.
No, that's an interesting point. I mean, because given the fact that, you know, property is for the long term, and when you look, I'm one of those people that always end up looking at the rich list every time, every year it's published every year, and I always see the same reasons why the people are in the top 100, and vast majority of them tend to be property, you know, held property, been given property, and they've maintained it for centuries in the family. So properties, it seems to be, you know, far better place to be than equities long term.
It's been very good, hasn't it, in this country, because of, you know, the shortage of supply, for certainly residential for a long time, but that doesn't mean it will always be the best. I mean, certainly if you look at the very long term studies, it doesn't outperform equity over the very long term in general. I think it's been an aberration in this country, to be honest, and it's you know, at some point that will be corrected.
Yeah, everything returns to the mean, doesn't it? Eventually.
Yeah, I mean, the interesting point you made was, you know, about, you mentioned gold as well and the flight to gold. And the other interesting thing we've seen since the referendum is bond yields, isn't it?
Yes.
It's now at these, I think, point sort of about 0.75% now on 10-year gilts. I mean, just, and then of course, you know, in many parts of the market, negative yields.
NERP and ZERP, as I call them.
I mean, absolutely crazy situation, isn't it, where people, you know, are actually, you know, buying a bond that's going to return less to them.
I mean, I think yesterday when I looked, the 10-year German bond was minus 0.17%. Now, I don't understand what that means. You know, are you giving them 99 pence or 99 euros or one euro and getting 0.99 at some point in 10 years' time? Doesn't make any sense to me, that.
It is crazy, isn't it? I mean, as I understand it, you know, the only reason you would do it as a private investor is the greater fool theory.
Right.
So you're going to come along and buy it at an even higher price.
Yeah.
And I understand why banks have to do it for regulatory reasons. I mean, that's crazy too, but at least, you know, they have to maintain certain capital buffers. They have to be in liquid assets, that kind of thing. But for private investors to be buying those things at the moment, I don't know. Personally, to me, it does seem a bit crazy.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I agree with that. Now, Nick, I wanted to swing back to your personal style, really, of investing and what you've learned, because our audience loves to learn from people's journeys and all the rest of it. And mistakes, yeah. The mistakes are what makes the journey, aren't they? The mistakes are what gives us the route to anchor to as we grow, I think.
Yes.
Now, if you wanted to touch on one of your greatest investment mistakes, then we'll start there if you like.
Well, I mentioned the gold fund.
Yes, yeah.
That was a fairly big one.
Yeah.
What other mistakes have I made? I'm not sure if it was a mistake or not, but I mean, it's perhaps an interesting story. I mean, I also invested not so long ago in a biotech fund.
Right, okay.
This was the second experience that led me to believe I shouldn't be investing in sector-specific funds. So I did the gold fund.
Yeah.
I lost money on that. I probably sold it about the worst possible time, you know, and I did all the classic kind of errors that investors make, you know. And I kind of knew at the time when I sold that gold fund, I kind of knew I was doing it. It was down, you know, I don't know, 30%. I just knew it would bounce back up as soon as I sold. I didn't have a big holding in it, to be honest, but I knew it would bounce back up as soon as I sold it, and it, you know, it didn't take very long for that to happen. So that, as I said, that was a mistake of trying to call a market based on a macroeconomic idea. But the other one was this biotech fund I invested in, and this investment went the opposite way. It's actually made a load of money, and it's pretty much doubled in value. Open.
Yeah.
But that just made me very nervous, so I sold it.
Right, okay.
And actually, that was, in retrospect, the right decision. But that doesn't necessarily mean it was a rational decision.
Right, okay.
It was a decision based just as much on gut instinct.
Mm. Yeah,
I got nervous because it had made so much money in such a quick time. But I think those two stories just told me that, you know, I don't have the capacity or the knowledge or the resources to make those kind of timing calls on
particular
sectors.
Yeah.
I did badly on one and well on the other, but that wasn't, you know, wasn't to do with judgment. It was just pretty much pure luck.
Yeah.
So since then, I've steered clear of that, and I've stuck to diversified portfolios where managers actually have the ability to shift in and out of sectors. And of course, they might get it wrong, and I don't have a blind faith in their ability to get it right all the time. But I think, you know, they have better resources at their disposal to be able to make those kind of judgments.
Indeed. Now, you've touched on your other better successes. Is there any other examples you want to give and the reasons why you actually made those decisions? Because I'm speaking with different people, and I spoke to a wonderful lady last night, Catherine Stott, who has written a book, and she's a coach. She does hypnosis and NLP to help traders, and she reckons that psychology makes up about 80 to 90% of our decision making, and if we haven't addressed that, then that's when we're at our weakest, really. So we have to grow and nurture that aspect so we can stick with trades and cut losses as such.
Yeah, I think that's a very, very interesting thing, and I've read a bit around it as well.
Yeah.
And it seems what we do is post-rationalization.
Mm-hmm.
We make decisions on an emotional basis, and then we make up a kind of rational reason why we've done it. And, I, you know, we do that in our personal lives all the time with our relationships and all the rest of it, and we also do it in our investment. And if we think we don't, the most dangerous thing, as you say, if we think we're being totally rational all the time, that's actually when we're being most irrational.
Indeed.
The same, and they've done analysis of fund managers, and you know, they're just as emotional as us.
Yeah.
So you need to actually harness that and you know, acknowledge it and then keep it in check. You know, I'm absolutely in agreement about that. I mean, one experience I did have that taught me quite a lot is before I got interested in investing in funds, I spent a short time doing online currency trading.
Oh, wow, okay.
Now, thank goodness I never actually invested any real money, and I was just using a demo account, but I did spend a lot of time on it, and I took it quite seriously to see if I could find strategies that were going to make me money in currencies. And I just realized a few things about that. I realized how utterly random the movement of currencies
is.
With a billion reasons why, you know, they've moved up or down at any particular time, but trying to predict that in advance is really, really, really hard. I won't say it's impossible. There's a few people in the world who can do it, and they get the decision. Maybe they get, you know, 51% of decisions right, and that's what makes them their edge. But, you know, for normal mortals to do it, it really is extremely difficult. And I realized how easy it was to kid yourself when I was doing that.
Yeah.
Acting rationally, you were following a strategy, when actually, you know, really you were just gambling.
Yeah, yeah.
And so that was quite an interesting experience.
Yeah, there's many an individual that was caught up in that wave between, I think it was 2000, so it's about 2010, that the Holy Grail was FX trading, and that's the place to go to make very quick money, fast money, and become a millionaire overnight. And a lot of accounts were just wiped out and never to be returned again.
Absolutely. And I just, you know, realized one very basic thing, that when you're trading currencies, there is no, how can I put it, fundamental reason for it to go one direction or another.
Yeah.
And when you're looking at stocks, you've got inflation on your side, which is going to generally move stock prices up.
Yeah.
Time. Then you've got companies increasing their earnings, which is going to do the same. So you have factors working in your favor that are actually pushing that in the right direction. With currencies, you know, it could go either way so easily.
Yeah, indeed. Now, Nick, I wanted to touch on the fact that there was something that was put out by Stifel this week, some research going back to your piece of your area of work, which said about 2/3 of investment trusts that were market capped above 100 mil had increased in their share price post referendum, and they covered Latin America, Chinese emerging companies, global healthcare. Now, why do you think certain areas, including Japanese actually, were up more than 11%? Why do you think certain sectors benefited from the post-referendum rather than others which got battered?
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting bit of research, actually. And looking at my portfolio as well, I was seeing my emerging markets go up,
my
Chinese holdings going up, all of that stuff that's had a really rough time.
The weaklings of the year seem to have done really well.
Yes, I know. I think some of this is currency-driven. Japan going up.
Yeah.
The yen has been one of the beneficiaries of, you know, the pound going down, so that, you know, the pound against the yen, you know, has fallen hugely, and that's obviously going to boost all those Japanese funds that are denominated in sterling. I think the same thing is happening on the FTSE 100. You've got a lot of companies which earn in dollars, but have share prices in pounds. So people who are looking at the FTSE 100 and thinking this is a great sign that the UK economy is, you know, coming out strongly from this, I think they're mistaken. That really is a currency-driven move.
Yeah, because the farmers have done quite well out of that, haven't they, recently? And the oil stocks have done well, and the gold stocks and the FTSE 100 have done well as well because of the currency movement, because they've got so much overseas money's coming in.
Yeah, so there's a certain amount of movement to defensives, I suppose, as well, with the farmers and that, and gold. But I think the rest is really currency-driven.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. Now, Nick, I've more or less covered all my questions. I've got two more that I wanted to ask you, and I might even be cheeky and ask a third one. If there was one thing you could change regarding the investing landscape, what would it be?
Well, I think what I'd like to see in this country, in the UK, is people actually a normalisation of equity investing, and that to become part of our core culture. Because I don't think it is. In the US, I think it's much more the case that people think it's normal to hold stocks and shares, and people might have stock in their own companies and things like that in their pensions. And I think here, there's a nervousness about the stock market. Mm-hmm. Even I only have to look at people like my parents, and as I said, no background in finance.
Yeah.
But, you know, they're not stupid people. And yet there's this fear of the stock market, something very unfamiliar to them. There's no reason why they shouldn't be more clued up about the stock markets and actually use it. I think if you look at the number of people in this country who open cash ISAs, I mean, ISAs have been enormously successful. And, you know, but you know, 80% of ISAs that are opened are cash ISAs. You know, a lot of people are just not looking at the stock market, not even considering it. And I think that's a shame. So I wish, you know, people were better informed about it and just weren't scared of it.
Okay. I mean, that's part of the work that you guys are doing at AIC, obviously, to influence that. But do you think that the banks and the industry per se of the financial industry needs to do more in educating the ordinary individual about investing long term rather than just putting them in cash ISAs? Do you think
Yeah,
that's what's needed?
I think we are aware that we need to do more, and I think we are trying to do more. And certainly, throughout my career, when I was at, what investment, it was all about, trying to simplify investment
Yeah.
because it doesn't need to be complicated. And sometimes we do make it too complicated.
Yeah.
Going on about discounts and premiums and Z scores and alpha and beta and Sharpe ratios, you don't
Yeah.
need all that to have a basic understanding of the stock market.
Yeah, just less jargon and more understanding. Yeah.
Absolutely. And also, I suppose people are very conscious these days. They have to give a balanced picture of things and emphasize the risks of the stock market. And that's great, and that's as it should be. But sometimes in emphasizing the risks of stock market investing, we actually scare people off. And I think a good example of that is questionnaires that advisors give clients to work out what their risk tolerance
Risk
is,
tolerance,
where they ask them questions like, would you be prepared to see a 20% loss in your investment portfolio or something like that? And people go, oh my gosh, 20%, no,
Of
I
course
don't want that.
not.
So they end up as a risk six. Whereas actually, somebody explained to them, well, actually, typically over the long term, stock markets go up. Here's how stocks have done relative to cash over the last 100 years. There's a lot of debate at the moment about what the long term means and over what period you should be investing in stocks and shares. Most people would say about 10 years, 5 to 10 years. Some people would argue longer. Paul Lewis, the money journalist, has recently released some research, and he thinks it's more like 20 years. But we all agree there's a period. There's a period over which becomes sensitive to the stock market, and that's what people perhaps don't understand. So people are too fixated on the risks. And as we both know, and as many of your listeners know, when stocks outperform, they outperform by a country mile, and that's why you should be invested in them. The trouble is, you just don't know when those periods of outperformance are going to be.
Yeah, no,
Don't lose 20%. And that's why people get so worried about it and concerned about it.
I completely agree, and that touches on one of my favorite quotes by a guy called Nick Murray, and he says, "Time in the market, as opposed to timing the market, is not a way of capturing the long-term returns of equities. It is the only practical way. You have to stay in it to win it." One of my favorite quotes, that.
No, that's a great quote. And the other one I heard recently from Nick Train, one of our fellows
Okay,
on Finsbury Growth and Income,
he's a bit of a legend, yeah, Nick.
the legend Nick Train. He describes himself as a perma bull. So as equity fans go, you can't get much more of a fan than that. It's just better to be bullish all the time. You end up looking pretty silly at some points, but actually over the long term, you'll probably do better being bullish all the time than you will being bearish all the time. And of
Right,
course,
okay.
that's right. The other interesting thing he said was that if you're trying to work out if there's a pattern to equity market returns, can you work out when to get in, when to get out, when the good period is going to be? He said, the only bit of wisdom I can give on that is actually a quote from Ogden Nash, who was the US humorist,
Yeah.
that shake and shake the ketchup bottle, none will come, and then a lot'll. And
All
for me,
right.
that's the best way to get across how equity markets work.
Right, I've not heard that one before. I like that.
Well, it's
It's
true, isn't it? I mean,
absolutely spot on.
you can spend years being totally miserable in equity. Let's not forget, you can have very, very long periods where they don't make any money and they make losses. But you stay in long enough, it will turn around, and then you'll get those really amazing periods where you make up all your losses and more.
Completely agree. I mean, I did see one that he did a little while back, and he said, "People who are pessimist and cynical, I observed, don't do particularly well in this industry." I was like, "Yes, that sounds about right."
The other thing Nick said actually, which was funny, was he said, "Be an optimist. It's healthier. Optimists are healthier. Bulls are healthier. They live longer lives. They have longer lives, and they don't get so many health problems." So yeah, I'm definitely of that school of thought.
Completely agree. I mean, you'll see, because we do follow each other on Twitter now. You'll see my mindfulness tweets and things about looking after yourself, and giving kindness. I'm all about positivity, and that's included in my investment strategies as well as my personal life.
absolutely right. And you know, sometimes on Twitter it can be easy to forget those things, and you know, you can get caught up in squabbles and,
yes,
you know,
indeed,
personality clashes. But yeah, I think, you know, the idea of mindfulness and taking a step back, I think, is a really important one.
No, I agree on that. Now, Nick, I've covered, I've got one more question. I've covered all my other questions. I think you might have already answered this, but I'm going to just try and tweak it a little bit so I might get a different answer slightly, or an additional answer, should I say. Now, in your opinion, your personal opinion, what is the best kept secret to investing?
Oh, gosh. Well, there's a really easy answer to that.
Okay, go for it.
I wish I'll have to give you. And that, I'm afraid, is use investment companies. I mean, I don't mean to do a sales pitch for investment companies.
Right. No, that's fine.
I genuinely think, you know, if people are under-informed about equity markets, they're even more under-informed about investment companies. And it's, you know, part of it is our fault for not actually talking up the benefits more, for not doing more marketing communications that we're trying to address now and get out, as I mentioned. But I think, you know, people are sort of, they don't know, genuinely just don't know about investment companies. Is that a problem? Or if they do know, they might be put off and scared, think they're more complicated. But I think, you know, the basic principle behind an investment company where you have an independent board looking after the shareholders and where you actually give the fund manager tools to enable them to outperform. For example, gearing. For example, a closed-ended structure where you don't have to worry about inflows and outflows, which is exactly the problem we're seeing in the property sector at the moment for open-ended funds. You know, those things are really powerful in enabling investment companies to deliver some really good performance over the long term. So the thing is, there's also an idea sometimes you need to be wealthy to invest in investment companies. And, you know, there are regular savings schemes starting from about £10 a month. So I know we've got a big problem in the UK, and I know sometimes in the finance industry we go on and on at people to save, especially young people, indeed, and don't recognise they don't actually have any money to save.
Yes.
But the point I would make is just start doing it. I don't care if it's £10 a month. You know, just start, get into that habit of saving a little bit every month, and then you'll find that as you go on, hopefully you'll be able to increase those monthly contributions, and you'll just get used to the idea of saving. Pound cost averaging and compounding are our two most powerful friends, I think, and that's something that people should always have in mind.
Yeah, I would agree on that. I mean, I'm a big fan of compounding, and what happens with your dividend, unfortunately. I mean, my parents were given shares in the companies that they worked with, and every time they got their dividends, it was like, oh, that's that free money, I'm going to take that and spend that, you know, every quarter or every 6 months that they got it. And it was only when I was about 30, I think, I had this conversation with, right, do you actually need that money? No, we don't, Pete, we just take it out because that's a bonus for us. I'm like, well, leave it there and just buy some more shares. And they actually took my advice, and my dad's been tapping me on the back ever since regarding his Croda shares. My mum had Alma shares at the time, you know?
Yeah.
So they've done very well out of those two companies.
Yeah, eighth wonder of the world, isn't it?
Yes, indeed. Completely agree. Now, Nick, we've covered all the questions. I want you to touch on your dividend heroes. I touched on with Annabelle as well, and explain that again to those that missed that particular conversation about what dividend heroes are and which ones are the best current dividend heroes in your sector.
Well, dividend heroes is just a kind of cute name we've come up with at the AIC for a kind of group of investment companies that have increased their dividends for very, very long periods. And when I say long periods, I mean anything from 20 years to 50 years in a row. So it's worth just take a step back to think about how incredible that is, because, you know, 50 years of increasing your dividends every single year is something that I think is unrivaled in the world for any collective fund. And the record holder is City of London Investment Trust. But there's a lot more that have got these very, very long records of increasing dividends. The reason that they can do it, apart from obviously good stock selection, is actually the revenue reserve, being able to hold back up to 15% of the dividends they get from their portfolio every year and put that in a sort of rainy day pot, if you like, to distribute in a future year where dividends from the market might have fallen.
Yeah, that's a smoothing effect that was mentioned by Annabelle.
Smoothing. So this has worked really, really well. And it's got a clearly a very long history of some funds being able to do this very consistently. Now, of course, it's not a guarantee. They'll always be able to do it in the future, but I can assure you, if you're City of London and you've increased dividends for 50 years in a row, you're pretty focused on making the 51, 52, and 53.
Indeed.
You know, to be on your watch that, you know, there's the first dividend cut. So those track records are really amazing. And if you're somebody who relies, like, you know, your parents used to spend their dividends, you know, if you're somebody who likes to spend your dividends, and let's face it, you know, some people, that's what they're holding it for. They need to spend it. They need to use it to pay the gas bill or whatever.
Yeah.
Want to know that there's a good chance the income is going to go up every single year. So that's one of the really kind of overlooked benefits of investment companies. And, you know, the fact that even though people look at the capital returns, the total returns, and they rightly say they're quite volatile due to discounts and gearing and so forth, the income returns can actually be extremely smooth for some, not all, but for some investment companies.
Yeah. No, it's brilliant, Nick. Thank you for that. I was just been looking at the list that you guys put up on the AIC back in June. And City of London, 50 years. Bankers Investment Trust, 49. Alliance Trust, 49. Caledonia, 49. Foreign Colonial Global Smaller Companies, 45. And their investment trust, 45. So you've got some staggering numbers there.
Yes, and there's actually quite a lot of sort of diversity within those.
I mean,
they are all pretty much investing in equities, but you've got UK equities, you've got global equities. If you look further down the list, you'll even start seeing some things like, you know, UK smaller companies, Asia Pacific, and you know, quite long track records from some different sort of strategies as well.
Yeah, and then you've got what they're calling, is it the new kids on the block, they're calling them? The new generation of ones that are 11 to 18 years?
That's
Aurora, which I've not heard of before as an investment company to look at.
Precisely, you know, more than 10 but less than 20, you're the next generation. Yeah, and you've got things like Mark Barnett's Investment Trust, Perpetual Income and Growth.
Yeah, saw that one, 16 years or such, yeah.
Yeah, that's right, something like that. And then you've got Aberdeen New Dawn, I believe, on, you know, about 10 or 11.
Yeah.
Edinburgh Investment Trust that was managed by Neil Woodford and is now managed by Mark Barnett. That's just 10. Murray International, you know, global equity income portfolio, quite high yielding, is on 10. So there is, you know, you can put
together opportunities out there, isn't there? Definitely. Yeah.
Yeah, you could put together a fairly diversified portfolio from these. But when I say diversified, I mean they're all in equities.
Yeah.
But quite sort of diversified equity income portfolio. And you know, if you want, you know, you can obviously combine that with other things. You don't have to have your whole portfolio in these things. You can have some, you know, cash if you want, or whatever, but you know, they're a powerful component portfolio for anyone who's looking for that rising income every year.
Well, I was certainly convinced. I'm even more convinced. I've been spoken to Annabelle and now speaking to you, and I did say after Annabelle's interview that I would increase my exposure to you know, investment companies, and I will definitely be doing that over the next couple of months.
Well, that's great to hear. We've convinced one person anyway.
Well, we're going to convince even more after I put this podcast out, Nick. Nick, I've covered all my questions. It's been absolutely wonderful to have you on Conquest Corner. Appreciate you coming on. Is there anything else you wanted to add before we close?
Not at all. It's been a very very good to speak to you. I don't think I've got anything in particular to add. The only thing I haven't really mentioned is an obvious point, but look at your external charges as well when you're investing.
Of course, yes. Sorry,
charges. Make sure you're making full use of your tax relief, your ISAs and pensions, you know, keep your trading costs down. I think if you do those things, then you know you're well on the way to getting some good returns.
That's absolutely a great point. Thanks for adding that on there, Nick. Much appreciated. Okay then, Nick, I'm going to thank you, sir, and let you get back to your day job. Really, really appreciate you being on LSE Share Talk, Conquest Corner, and I look forward to speaking with you and working with you again in the future at some point.
Great to talk to you. Thanks very much.
All right. Take care. God bless.
Bye.
Bye.